Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Anthony Viores, registration number 18508 on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Deanna Soitcher. There are three arguments raised in the opening brief. I'm going to try to address all three. I'm going to focus most of my time on the first argument, which is that the non-cooperation affirmative defense was waived or improperly pled by State Farm.
Mr. Viores, I'm going to interrupt you right out of the chute and, wow, and kind of shift gears on you, if you wouldn't mind, because I'm just tell both of you, at least I personally am struggling with in this case, is the trial by implied consent, and I want to make sure that gets addressed.
Okay.
So, I'll promise I'll give you time to go back. But so you're, as I understand your argument, you're saying that the plaintiffs really thought they were addressing the good faith defense in this trial, well, all the evidence and non-cooperation, whatever, came out. And I understand that. What I guess I'm struggling with is what would y'all have done differently? I mean, they're hearing this evidence that they didn't respond to these requests. So two questions for you. What would you have done differently, and you meaning your client, where was the prejudice here, and does it matter? I mean, am I even asking the right question on a trial by implied consent?
All right, well, let me address your question right out of the chute as well. I would say that it certainly does make a difference. It was not tried by consent. It's our position that clearly State Farm had the right to claim that to defend itself on the basis that the claim was not unreasonably denied or delayed. And as far as delay being the main issue here. They gave their offer the day before the statute of limitations ran. So their very first offer in this case. So that they wanted to say that was not unreasonably delayed under these circumstances. And that's why they kept saying, well, Ms. Soitcher failed to turn over the releases timely. That was their main claim. And that prevented us from timely adjusting the claim. So the duty to cooperate, we agree that the cooperation was generally raised at this trial. I mean, it was. But only as it pertained to their failure to timely adjust the claim. That is it. That is the only reason the lack of cooperation generally, and I'm not talking about non-cooperation defense, they're very different. The lack of cooperation generally was raised by State Farm, we consented to that because that was their defense. We consented that they could raise the issue generally in addressing the issue of why they delayed so long in adjusting the claim. But that is not a non-cooperation defense. That is an affirmative defense, Your Honor.
Help me understand. I guess I'm not getting the distinction you're making between, you know, they're defending themselves on unreasonable delay by mm-hmm. saying non-cooperation versus a non-cooperation defense.
Okay, so here's why. Because among other things, there's elements to the non-cooperation defense. And I would say the most important for purposes of this discussion would be a material and substantial disadvantage. All right, they've got to prove that. That is an element. They don't win a non-cooperation defense unless they prove it. And that was never raised. And so it's our position, and Mr. Hemet, trial counsel, did state that he would have gotten an expert to address this issue, whether State Farm was materially and substantially disadvantaged by the delay in receiving the releases. I mean, they even sort of admitted that they really weren't all that harmed by it. I mean, they got the releases 14 months before the statute ran.
But their adjuster did get up and testify that they were prejudiced and
there's like one paragraph in this entire 7-day trial where she said that. But yes, she did say that. But Mr. Hammond would have addressed that issue. He would have gotten, and believe me, there are insurance defense experts out there. There are, you know, insurance bad faith experts out there. And Mr. Hammond's hired them in the past, as have I, who can address these issues, whether the material and substantial disadvantage was experienced by State Farm.
Well, when you say this is a non-cooperation defense, it's not disputed that it was an actual provision of the contract, right?
It was.
And so can you give me an example of another kind of affirmative defense that is based on a specific provision of the contract?
I can't off the top of my head, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay, so that's kind of what I'm trying to get my brain around, is that it seems to me like most of the time affirmative defenses are something like outside the contract. But here we have a provision of the contract that wasn't complied with. And I understand if it's a mutual breach, you know, it has to be material, et cetera, et cetera. But does it matter whether we call it an affirmative defense or something else, a condition precedent or something?
And I would say yes, absolutely. I mean, it's got to be a material breach. It's got to be a substantial breach. It's got to be a breach that excuses the performance of the defendant. So if you delay, but there's no harm, then that doesn't excuse their conduct. That doesn't excuse their non-performance. If you delay and it's a minor issue that doesn't have any impact whatsoever on the adjustment of the claim, it doesn't excuse their performance. So it's got to be sufficient enough. It is a condition of the contract, but it only rises to the level of an affirmative defense, excusing their conduct, excusing their performance, if you meet the elements of the non-cooperation affirmative defense, which include material and substantial disadvantage. So yes, it's a condition of the contract, but it's, so in terms that you just raised, Judge Boris, it was not a material breach of the contract. And they have to plead a material breach. They have to plead that. It's either a condition precedent, meaning they don't have to pay if you breach this condition, or it's an affirmative defense. It's one or the other. They didn't plead it either way. They didn't plead it as a condition precedent. They didn't plead it as an affirmative defense. They just said generally in the answer, plaintiff did not fulfill all the conditions of the contract. It's a standard answer, a pat answer. Everybody does it.
Okay, so now I guess I'm moving over to the trial by implied consent piece of it.
Okay.
And so I understand totally that if it's not enough just to have some evidence of something that doesn't get you there.
Yes.
But here it looks like we have more because we do have not a specific pleading, but a general pleading. One side says we performed our duties under the contract. The other side says, no, you didn't. And then wasn't there reference in an argument, opening argument? And then there's evidence. Why doesn't this take us beyond the general rule that it's not enough just to put on evidence?
Because again, the only issue in the case was that was tried was, or the main issue, I should say, in the case that was tried was whether State Farm unreasonably delayed their offer, which they made the day before the statute of limitations expired. We submit that that's pretty late in the game, Your Honor. 2 years and 364 days before the statute of limitations expired. So yes, they're allowed to bring in the contract to show that, well, we didn't meet our obligations to you to timely adjust the claim, or we didn't meet our duty of good faith and fair dealing because you didn't comply with this contractual provision.
Mr. Viewers, I'd like to ask you a question about what you just mentioned about good faith and fair dealing. I didn't see very much explanation in either of the briefs about State Farm's argument that Ms. Soischer didn't meet her obligation to exercise good faith and fair dealing. How is good faith and fair dealing different from non-cooperation?
I believe, Your Honor, that the good faith and fair dealing claim, I don't believe that went to the jury. But as far as your question goes, each side does have a duty to act in good faith, and in a first party context, especially where you're dealing with your own insured, the insurer clearly has that duty, and the case law says there's a reciprocal duty of the insured to treat its
right care. I understand that. So what specifically does that mean that the insured has to do to satisfy an obligation of good faith and fair dealing?
I think the insured probably should timely turn over releases.
How is that different from cooperation?
I think they're virtually synonymous, Your Honor. One's a common law duty, one's a contractual duty, there's also a statutory duty. The complaint was kind of played all three ways.
So that's what I'm trying to inquire about, Mr. Viewers. If the issue of good faith and fair dealing was before the jury, and your argument is that non-cooperation wasn't before the jury, and yet you just said that they're basically synonymous. So was there any prejudice then?
Well, I don't think the good faith and fair dealing claim went to the jury.
Let me be clear, Mr. Viewers. There was an effort, I just want to make sure you're understanding. I think I'm tracking with Judge Taubman, maybe
okay.
You're not.
I apologize.
There was an affirmative defense pled
yes, there
of
was.
Good faith
there
and
was.
Fair dealing.
Yes.
And Judge Taubman's asking the same question I sort of have. What you've kind of said, there's no difference. You're saying we were not on notice of this affirmative defense. If they're the same, you were certainly on notice of the affirmative defense of not good faith.
Well, again, all right. So getting to the specific case, look, is good faith and fair dealing the same as cooperation under the contract? Yes, it may be in a sense, in terms of the obligations of the insured. But again, the insurer, the carrier, good faith and fair dealing, as I said, didn't go to the jury, so I haven't addressed all the elements of it. But there is the material and substantial disadvantage aspect of the non-cooperation claim. The insurer...
That's not also an element of good faith.
Not to my knowledge.
So in other words, yes. Non-cooperation may be evidence of a lack of good faith, but not the other way around.
Right. You have to have that material and substantial disadvantage. That's really the missing element here. If Mr. Hammond had known that, trial counsel had known that, he could have addressed that. And, you know, I feel a little bit on the defensive here, but I understand the court has questions and I'm happy to answer them. But I would ask you please to consider State Farm's actions in this case, all right? Because the lack of notice in our minds is really, it's egregious. It is egregious, Your Honors. I mean, they can't bootstrap the good faith and fair dealing affirmative defense onto into a defense of non-cooperation. They are not the same. In Colorado case law, there's a case called ICE, which this court has issued, which states specifically you can't morph one affirmative defense into another. You can't do it, all right? Affirmative defenses are different than general denials. If they're not notice pleading, yes, we have that in this state, but as to affirmative defenses, they have to be pled with particularity. This was a cab case, so it had even more particularity requirements than others. And never did the issue of consent ever see the light of day until after the evidence was closed. All right, after the evidence was closed, John. I'm not even talking about mid-trial. I'm talking about after the evidence was closed. And I'm talking about the non-cooperation defense. I'm not talking about the issue generally of cooperation. We are distinguishing between those things. All right.
Let me summarize what I think you're arguing, and you could use your time wisely or get to the other issues you want to address. I think your position here is you didn't have any notice you were trying an affirmative defense of non-cooperation. If you did, you would have known that you had to put on evidence of the prejudice to or lack of prejudice to the insurance company, and Mr. Hemmett would have called an expert. That's the prejudice. That's why you were harmed and you didn't know what you were trying. You were trying this other issue that didn't have this element. Is that your position?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. And so I'm going to sit down here because I do want to address what he has to say. But I just want to, I do believe, though, that the acts and omissions of counsel can have to be put in sort of a context. And I think the mental state of defense counsel does sort of shed some light on the context in which you should view these things. And what defense counsel said in his opening statement, Your Honors, and he's tried to disavow this ever since. He says, because whatever damages you assess against Mr. Manuki, State Farm is going to be liable for under its uninsured motorist coverage. I mean, how do you get around that? How do you get around that? I mean, if nothing else, even if he can say, well, I didn't mean it, statements of counsel aren't evidence, blah, blah, blah. You know, the fact is that was his mindset because he never knew he was going to raise the non-cooperation defense. He never knew it until the close of evidence. And then to saddle us with that, and then we lose our case because of it, is totally and completely unfair. All right, I'll sit down.
We have just over 2 minutes.
Yeah, thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please this court. My name is Thomas Seaman. I practice with the law firm of Frank Patterson and Associates, and my registration number is 4172. I represent State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company in this case. The issue, as Mr. Viorst has presented to this court, is whether or not State Farm provided notice to its insured that this non-cooperation issue existed in this claim. Mr. Viorst says that the lack of notice is egregious. I would submit that there was notice at every phase of this case, and any civil litigation has got several phases, beginning even before litigation is filed, all the way up through trial.
Mr. Seaman, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm going to do this because all's fair in love and war here. I'm going to interrupt you like I interrupted Mr. Norris. And let me start with the premise of what you just said, which I'm not sure Mr. Viewers would agree with. There's one piece of saying there's notice that this cooperation issue, there's another issue about whether you pled an affirmative defense of non-cooperation, which would put burdens on you, and Mr. Viewers says has certain elements to it. And so I don't think there's any issue. They knew there was facts out there that they didn't respond promptly to your releases, requests, et cetera. I think that's a different issue. Of whether you pled an affirmative defense and they were on notice that that's what was being tried. So
well, I know
with that,
read,
that
I know
premise, go for it, respond.
I know you've read our answer, so I know you are aware that the answer doesn't specifically set forth in paragraph form as affirmative defense or defense, you know, failure to cooperate. But two things. One, I would argue, and the trial court so found, that pleading the insured's failure to comply with their obligation of good faith and fair dealing was a substantial equivalent because it brought into the equation, if you will, the issue of non-cooperation. And that, I think it was raised in one of the earlier questions here today. It's part and parcel of that duty of good faith and fair dealing that both the insured and the insurance company bring to the table, so to speak, in one of these cases. Secondly, in this particular case, and this goes to the pleadings as a whole, there was a 10-page complaint with 52 numbered paragraphs, including a paragraph that included the allegation that the insured had complied with all of the conditions preceding to coverage. That's fairly unusual, actually, in terms of the way these cases are typically pled. A 52-paragraph, 10-page complaint is unusual in itself, but alleging affirmatively in the complaint that the insured has complied with all the conditions of the insurance policy sort of creates the, or lays the groundwork for that issue to be, you know, framed for the parties in the case. They allege compliance with all of the terms and conditions of the policy. We denied it in our answer. So I would submit to the court that whether you call it an affirmative defense or you call it a condition preceding to coverage, from the time of the initial pleadings in the case with the complaint and the answer, that the issue of cooperation or lack of cooperation was part of this case.
Don't those things have to be specifically pled? And if you just have an allegation of compliance and then a general denial, can that qualify as being specifically pled?
I think it can, Your Honor. I think, and I've seen answers, we file answers, where the pleading of the affirmative defense is really non-compliance with one or more conditions, terms or conditions of the insurance policy. Basically, what we're saying is we have a contract. There are conditions and terms of the contract that have not been met or complied with, and we include that allegation in our answer. Here, we denied an affirmative allegation in the plaintiff's complaint, said substantially the same thing. They alleged all of the conditions and terms of the policy have been met by the insured. Our answer said, no, they haven't. So the same message is being conveyed to the plaintiff's attorney by that answer as if we would have set it forth in a separate paragraph. But I don't think you have to go down the list of every policy term and condition and say, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, you didn't do that. I think it's sufficient to say you haven't complied with the terms or conditions of the insurance policy.
But if non-cooperation is an affirmative defense, and I recognize that that's an issue in this case and perhaps an issue of first impression, don't you have to plead it specifically? And so I can shut up and let you respond. Can you, so that's one question. Do you have to plead it specifically? And second, now you say good faith, the affirmative defense of good faith covered it, but isn't good faith broader, a broader concept than non-cooperation?
I think it is broader, but I also agree with Mr. Gorse that it includes or it's synonymous with cooperation as one element of that, but it includes other elements as well. I mean, the cooperation is just one term or provision in the insurance policy. There's additional provisions, in fact, there are additional provisions in this policy that were not met, one of which is specific to providing signed medical authorization so that the insurance company can obtain access to medical records. Here it was really tried under the broad rubric of cooperation in terms of what this insurer failed to do with State Farm. And I say that notice existed at every stage from prior to litigation when State Farm over a period of more than 2 years was communicating with its insured, and I think there were 8 or 9 letters that were introduced as a single exhibit, Exhibit R at trial, that documented all of that. And then at the disclosure phase, after the answer was filed and there were initial disclosures, we produced 900 plus pages of documents that included not only all of that correspondence, but all of the claim log notes showing, in addition to the correspondence, a long list of telephone conversations or attempted, you know, voicemail messages. So all of that was laid out there for the plaintiff and plaintiff's attorneys. And even though the plaintiff's attorneys had ended up representing Mrs. Soitier weren't representing her in those first couple of years. Once they had the disclosure, they could see exactly what had predated their representation and what problems those created. And then we got to the discovery phase, and I took depositions of Mr. and Mrs. Soitier, and they took the deposition of the State Farm claim representative. All three of those depositions were replete with testimony that was focused on the cooperation issue. I asked Mr. and Mrs. Soitier, did you get all these letters? What were you doing with these letters? Why weren't you calling State Farm back or responding? And when Mr. Hemet took the deposition of State Farm's claim representative, his focus was not on whether or not this non-cooperation had occurred, because pretty clearly it had. His focus instead was, well, how did this prejudice State Farm? How did this affect your ability to investigate and evaluate this claim? Because once our law firm got involved and we provided authorizations and information, then you had everything you needed.
Did he also take the position, and was there, I mean, this is a matter of, I guess, how you read the record. It seemed to me they're also basically taking the position, our delay in not responding was justifiable. Mr. Soitier was concerned about his wife healing and didn't want her to be focused on that. Am I reading that correctly? Was that a trial theme here?
That was their excuse, if you will. But there was also evidence that in fact what was going on is that they had two claims. She had two claims, two brain injuries, two different accidents 6 months apart. And during the time that she was not communicating with State Farm, she's represented by an attorney in Michigan who is pursuing a claim against another insurance carrier for her first brain injury. So she's saying, Mr. Soitier testified that he was trying to focus on his wife recovering and getting better. In fact, what was going on is he had a boyhood friend who was an attorney in Michigan representing her on a separate claim, and our argument to the jury was that they didn't communicate with State Farm because they didn't want to intermingle these two claims. They were trying to hold State Farm off on claim number two while claim number one was being resolved. And in fact, they resolved claim number one without ever referring at all to the second accident or the second brain injury. I mean, and that evidence came out of trial. So the jury had evidence that included an excuse for their non-cooperation, that she was, you know, injured, trying to heal, all of that, but they also had an alternative explanation for that. And I think in the end, the non-cooperation was evident, and I think largely conceded in the briefs filed in this appeal. I think the focus of the appellant's position is lack of prejudice. In other words, it did not cause a material or substantial disadvantage to State Farm. But that's a fact question. It's a fact question that the jury gets to decide, as long as there is evidence from which a reasonable jury could conclude that non-cooperation did cause a substantial disadvantage. And here there was direct testimony from the claim representative that as a result of the non-cooperation, we even used the magic words, you know, material and substantial disadvantage to State Farm. Obviously aware of the Secrets case, the Hansen versus Barmore case, the appellate decisions are clear in terms of what has to be established in order for that finding to be made, and that was the evidence that we presented, and that's how we presented it to the jury.
Mr. Seaman, just to clarify your position, is in your view, is non-cooperation either an affirmative defense, a condition precedent, or just a term of the contract that might or might not have been breached?
I think probably the latter two, and they sort of coexist. It's a condition preceding, and it's a condition preceding because it's a term of the contract.
So,
in other words, it's a contract condition, and it has to be met in order for there to be coverage.
So let me ask you a related question. One of the areas in which the parties disagree is whether there's a trial management order in the record. And Mr. Vior says that there isn't, and you, your brief proceeds on the assumption that there is.
We submitted a trial management order, and the court, in fact, in its order entering judgment, made reference to it in that order and said that in the trial management order, the parties conceded that the coverage was subject to the terms and conditions of the insurance policy. We certainly submitted a proposed trial management order to the court in this case, as we were required to do. I was under the impression, still under the impression, that the court reviewed it and approved it, but I understand that it's not part of the record that's before this court, and I can't, that's our fault, because I should have recognized that.
Okay, so you're conceding, it sounds like, that the trial management order is not in the record, is that correct?
Can't find it. I'm conceding that, Judge Feldman, because it's not there, and I trust Mr. Viewers when he points that out to the court in his brief.
Okay, thank you.
So I believe that the conditions for making this a fact question for the jury to decide have been met at really every stage of the proceedings. I mentioned the disclosure and discovery phase, but then when we actually got to trial, in opening statement, there was a reference to a reservation of rights letter and the fact that State Farm had contacted its insured and indicated to the insured that the failure to cooperate might prejudice or their existence of coverage. After the opening statement in the cross-examination of both the plaintiff and her husband, there was a great deal of questioning about the cooperation issue to both of those individuals. And then we presented the testimony by the claim representative, Ms. Vaughn. She testified that not only was there non-cooperation, but that it caused a material and substantial disadvantage. And finally, the jurors had two exhibits that really were key to the question. One was Exhibit F, which was the policy terms or conditions, just the excerpt that was specific to this issue, and Exhibit R, which was all the communications between State Farm over the course of more than 2 years where they were trying to elicit this cooperation. So all that evidence, first of all, I think is indicative of trying this issue by consent. If it hadn't already been presented prior to that, certainly it was presented to this jury by consent of the parties. If Mr. Hemet's position or the position of plaintiff's counsel is that, well, they thought that the only reason that the issue existed was as a defense to the extra contractual claims for bad faith and for a statutory claim, then that's their fault. I mean, for them to say, well, yeah, we knew all of this evidence was coming in on non-cooperation, but we misconstrued it. We thought what you were, that the goal or objective of all of that was just to defeat our extra contractual claims and had nothing to do with the
contract. But isn't there case law in the implied consent world that defends the exact position? If the evidence is consistent with the claims that are in the case, you're not giving them notice that a non-pled issue is in the case. That they have every right to believe this evidence is coming in for the reasons that were pled.
But,
not...
Your Honor, when they have, as one of the exhibits, the contract itself and the contract provision, and it says that a condition of coverage and payment of uninsured motorist benefits is compliance with this term, and they can't very well step back and say, well, yeah, we realize that that's a contract provision, it's a condition preceding, but we thought you were talking about something else.
Mr. Seaman, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Regarding notice, Your Honors, his proposed jury instruction submitted 3 days before trial did not contain a non-cooperation affirmative defense instruction. His 2.1 instruction, which was read to the jury, did not contain any reference to non-cooperation as a defense. He told the jury in opening statement he was going to pay the claim. There's just absolutely no notice in this case. Any trial lawyer will tell you if their defense is non-cooperation, they're going to submit a jury instruction during the pretrial phase of the trial, several days before trial. They're going to include that in their 2.1 instruction, which is read to the jury, telling them what the case is about. It was never done. And the reason it wasn't done is because Mr. Seaman didn't know he was going to raise that defense. In trial, the evidence starts going pretty well, and he's like, huh, all right, maybe I'll do this now, at the close of evidence. Regarding the issue of prejudice, Your Honors, I do want to say one other thing about that. We were denied the opportunity to address the material and substantial disadvantage element.
That's also a separate argument in my brief, that there was insufficient evidence of that, because again, we didn't address it, and it wasn't really, it's one paragraph in the entire trial. But there really wasn't any, the releases were submitted over a year before the statute ran. They had plenty of time to do it. But also, even after the case was filed, there was a year there too. And remember, this is a first party claim. They owe us a duty of good faith. And even for that year, they didn't do anything. And they still had the same number at trial that they did. It was the same number as their initial number. So they were not materially disadvantaged. As far as the TMO goes, there isn't a TMO. It's my understanding the parties had a dispute about the TMO, and they didn't submit a joint one, and so it never got signed by the court. I think there were dueling TMOs that were submitted to the court, but they never had an actual TMO in the record because it never existed. And finally, Your Honors, we were denied the opportunity to have instructions on affirmative defense. We didn't. The trial court did not instruct on affirmative defense. We didn't get proper instructions, and that's crucial. That's the additional prejudice we suffered. We would have asked for proper instructions if we'd have known this was coming, but we didn't, and the jury did not properly consider this affirmative defense.
Okay, Mr. Viorst, your red light is on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank both counsel for your excellent arguments. Again, we really appreciate the time that you spent on these cases. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. This concludes